These days, it's pretty common for kids to be at least a little bit fussy when it comes to the food they eat. But has it always been this way? In a word, no. If you look to writers who grew up in, say, the 19th century, they wax lyrical over memories of their favourite childhood foods that include things like oysters, tart pickles, cold jellied brain, which is pretty different from chicken nuggets and flavoured yogurt, right? Food historian Helen Zoe Veit has been studying a phenomenon she calls mass childhood pickiness for the past 10 years. Her new book looks at how meal habits, industrialization, and shifting parenting advice over the past two centuries have shaped the way our kids learn to eat. And you are, of course, about to hear from Helen, but I'd also love to know if this is something you've been thinking about. Were you a fussy eater as a kid, or are you helping to raise one now? With me is Helen Zoe Veit, Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University and the author of Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. Helen, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
So you're kind of calling American kids out here as the fussiest eaters in history. Is this a uniquely American phenomenon? Can't Australian kids be fussy too?
These days, it's not unique at all. Unfortunately, pickiness is spreading around the world, and it has been for decades. So although Americans got there first, we were the first population to have mass childhood pickiness. It's now in many places around the world, although still hardly all. We still have a lot of counterexamples and places where children are still being raised to eat what their parents eat and to like it.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what we used to be like before we invented Fruit Loops.
Yeah. So my research is centered on the United States, but the general pattern that I described is the sort of thing we would have seen in most human cultures in the history of our species. So in the 19th century United States, children ate an incredible diversity of foods because American cuisine was really diverse. There were not refrigerators, and there wasn't factory food processing for the most part. And so to preserve food at home, people were doing things like salting, pickling, fermenting, smoking. And as a result, the flavors of everyday foods tended to be quite funky, very interesting. They also had a lot of different species of plants, lots of different meats, different kind of, they were eating squirrels and rabbits and songbirds and all kinds of different shellfish, as well as organ meats. And you know, although we may have a sense that cuisine in the past was different, what was so striking to me is that children were described over and over again as loving this kind of diverse foods. It wasn't a question of them being forced to eat it, but of them learning from earliest toddlerhood to accept it and to like it.
Are we not maybe romanticizing the past a bit? Like before we had refrigeration, people had worse food security, that people sometimes got foodborne diseases. We have such a safe and abundant food supply now. Are we looking down our nose at that a little bit?
I don't think I am at all. As I say in the book, it's wonderful that we have so much abundance today, and that we have all of these technologies that allow us to preserve our foods. I don't think that I'm particularly nostalgic about the food of the past or the past in general. I don't want to go back to a time when I don't have a toothbrush. However, there were all kinds of structural parts of daily life that were creating an environment that made kids non-picky eaters. That's what I'm so interested in. Not necessarily the food supply itself. And it's true that not only was food poisoning a real issue, but of course there were epidemic diseases. This was the time before, you know, knowledge about germs or viruses. And children were uniquely vulnerable to those. Children died at really high rates. About 1 in 4 or 5 children died. And in fact, this very high rate of children's mortality was one of the things that prompted people to say, maybe children are eating too broadly. Maybe their food is actually hurting them. Maybe that's why they get sick so often. You know, again, before they knew about germs, people were searching for explanations for children's vulnerability to disease and to food poisoning. And a lot of them settled on food, which is one of the factors that helped to create children's food, this idea that this is a separate category and the children should have special bland food.
So you sort of look at sort of two centuries here. Talk to me about this evolution between kids eating brains. And I mean, people still eat them all over the world. Children do as well. But this idea that kids having very broad palates to what you're seeing now, special food, kids feeling like a much narrower palate?
Yeah, I think that the number one factor is hunger. When people today imagine why children in the past or in other cultures eat widely, they tend to assume that it was because of scarcity, that there wasn't enough food to go around, so that children forced down food that they didn't like at every meal. And it's true that some people were desperately poor, and poor children were especially likely to eat eagerly and indiscriminately. However, the amazing thing about children's eating in the 19th century was that it was a cross-class phenomenon, meaning that even children of the wealthiest industrialist in New York City, they were not picky. Children on prosperous farms weren't picky. Children of indigenous people who were living in situations of abundance, they weren't picky either. But I realized that many of those kids, even the ones who had plenty to eat overall, were still hungry when they came to their meals because there wasn't much snacking and there was much more activity and exercise. Children walked long distances, they did chores, they played outside. So children would come to meals with a big appetite. And if you've ever gone grocery shopping on an empty stomach, you know how much a sharp appetite can really intensify your interest in new foods. At the same time, they weren't given alternatives. So, you know, if a child had hesitated to eat a family meal, in most households, there simply weren't other things to give them. All of that changed in the 20th century. So starting in the early 20th century, nutrition science was emerging. People started saying that children should drink large amounts of whole milk, which really took up a lot of stomach real estate. It really suppressed appetites. Parents started paying attention to, you know, are children eating their spinach? Are they eating their vitamins and their nutrients? And that created this kind of artificiality and this emphasis on children having to eat certain things. At the same time, they were snacking much more. Food processing was on the rise. Highly processed, shelf-stable snacks were entering kitchen cabinets. And at the same time, by the mid-20th century, there was new advice streaming to parents, and especially to mothers, that they should not tell their children what to eat, that this was psychologically risky, that children might develop dysfunctional relationships with food, or they might not have a sense of their own authentic fullness, or they might rebel and develop lifelong aversions, or they might become overweight because they associated dessert with love and they thought of vegetables as punishment, something they had to do. All of these myths started circulating, and they really were myths. There was never really a single concrete, robust study comparing the psychological outcomes of children raised with different feeding methods. But these myths started circulating in American culture. They pushed American parents not to urge children to eat, not even to talk about health, just as children were less hungry when they came to meals and when there were all these really highly palatable factory foods as alternatives that were being marketed as kids' foods.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Helen Zoe Veit, who's an Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. She's the author of a new book called Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. Although, as Helen says, maybe Western children is the way to describe that. I wonder what pickiness has looked like in your family over the years, how you've dealt with it. Lots of people with a very similar perspective to you, I think, Helen. One person says, when my child refused good, fresh, healthy food, I told her stories of what my grandmother and family used to eat during the Depression, tripe, mutton, and brains, if they were lucky. Another says, I raised 5 children. They weren't picky because they ate what was offered. They weren't forced to eat anything they didn't like, but I rarely offered them a choice. This is how I was raised, and I didn't know any different. Now my grandchildren are sometimes picky because they have too much choice. Helen, you're not just writing this from an ivory tower. You have 3 young children of your own that you've been raising over the 10 years you've been also raising this book. How has your research influenced the way you've parented your own children?
Profoundly. I was spending my work days really in a totally different food culture where children ate things they were supposed to find disgusting today, where parents reacted very differently. And I brought that kind of confidence home with me as a parent. I say in the book that I don't have any doubt that all 3 of my children could have become just as picky as any other modern kid if I had followed the rules that parents are told they're supposed to follow. But I didn't. I did things like you know, trying to protect their appetites from snacks. So I certainly offered snacks, but I kept my eye on the clock, and I didn't offer them too close to meals. And if a child didn't want to eat something at first, I would enthusiastically, over and over again, encourage them to try it. Even if they rejected something, you know, by spitting it out and said, I don't want it, I would say, oh, you know, try it again. You're learning to like it. You know, give it another shot at the very same meal, over and over. That often did the trick and got them trying things. But if it didn't, I wouldn't offer an alternative. And at the end of the meal, I would say, you don't have to eat. You know, that's your decision. But I'm going to keep your food in the refrigerator. If you change your mind and you decide you're hungry, come back. If you have two more bites, we'll call that dinner and then you can have a snack or dessert. And for me and my children, that worked every single time. So that by the time they were young preschoolers, they were just eating every single thing my husband and I ate. And just one of the lessons of this book and one of the lessons of history is that when people hear about teaching kids to eat, they often think of it as forcing kids. And I would love to reorient the conversation to a conversation about teaching kids to experience all kinds of pleasures that they're currently denied because of the kind of food culture we have.
So this sounds like it's worked really well for you at a family level. Broadening that out to our food system, like, it's so pervasive. One text here from Jan says, commercial ads on kids' TV is the main problem. That's part of it. It's also on YouTube. It's every time you walk into a supermarket, you really can't escape it. Have you got some ideas of what structural change could look like if this is something that we want to shift?
Well, certainly the kind of direct marketing that we see to children of pretty unhealthy foods, almost by definition, the kinds of foods that are marketed and packaged as children's food tend to be factory products. There's growing evidence about correlations between diets that are heavy and highly processed foods and poor health outcomes. And currently in America, at least, two-thirds of the foods that American kids eat are highly processed. And we have resulting health problems, things like high rates of childhood obesity, the development of type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, heart problems in childhood, things that were vanishingly rare even just a generation or two ago. And I think if we start to think of this as a public health problem, we can start to do things like restrict the kind of direct marketing that we're seeing to children. We can do things like talk about what kind of food is served in public schools. We can provide cooking lessons in schools. This would be, I think, incredibly powerful in not only exposing children to new foods and new tastes, but also giving them tools to feed themselves in a healthier way in the future. Those are just a few of, I think, many policy changes that could potentially start to address this.
So that's at the broad level. At a small individual level, there are some kids who are picky or fussy, and you can get around that with maybe some of the techniques that you've mentioned. And then there's kids who are perhaps on the autism spectrum, maybe have something like avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. Is there a risk of conflating pickiness with something that might be a symptom of something that needs to be taken a bit more seriously and maybe not dismissed?
Yeah, certainly much more research is needed on this. One thing I can say as a historian is that it's hard to imagine a disorder like ARFID, which is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, developing outside of the context of mass childhood pickiness. One of the fascinating things about ARFID, which is a real disorder, children with ARFID are suffering. Their parents, I think, often suffer even more. It's incredibly stressful. It's affecting children's health. But the mind-bending thing about ARFID is that you really don't see large numbers of children exhibiting ARFID-like behaviors until the late 20th century. ARFID actually didn't become an official eating disorder until 2012, which is less than 15 years ago. So in the sweep of our history as a species, which is 300,000 years, it does seem like something cultural, maybe you know, cementing or reinforcing this kind of extreme pickiness that is, again, you know, really a real phenomenon for parents. But I think the idea that it is absolutely biologically immutable, it's almost certainly more complicated than that. One reason that I have for saying that with some confidence is that I've been talking to some practitioners and pediatricians who are working with children who have ARFID or other sensory disorders that make them extreme picky eaters. And they're finding that with really assertive exposure therapy, multiple positive exposures to the same food. And when I say multiple, I mean sometimes dozens and dozens and dozens. They're finding that even children who were extremely restricted in their eating are able to learn to accept foods that their parents had previously thought were just completely impossible for them biologically. So it's a very complicated issue. But I think, you know, one of the things I hope to do with this book is to inject some cultural perspective into what had previously been a pretty narrowly medicalized view of the subject.
It's a pretty charged topic. You sort of mentioned before the idea of parents worrying about their kids in the 19th and 20th century, that they weren't eating the right food. We still worry about our kids today. It sort of seems like it's eternal. What kind of response have you got from the book? Are people defensive or are people grateful to have maybe a bit of a roadmap?
That's a great question. I was very nervous before publishing the book because I was keenly aware of how incredibly sensitive it is for parents. Parents have gotten just really contradictory advice on this. On the one hand, they're told children's food matters. It affects children's health. Children's health rates children's health has been suffering for various reasons I've already outlined. On the other hand, they're told children's food doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. Children will naturally choose a healthy diet as long as you don't push them. But if you push them, you can mess your kid up. Parents feel really paralyzed. They feel frustrated. They feel angry. Some people feel shame. This seems like an issue with incredibly high stakes. Parents are trying to do the best they can, and yet they've gotten really poor advice about how best to try to push back against or to completely in some cases, prevent pickiness altogether. And I've been actually shocked by the positive reaction to my book. I expected people to be defensive and angry. I've actually gotten much less of that than I expected. And again, my expectations may have been pretty low, but I have been positively just almost overwhelmed by how many people have reached out and said, have expressed gratitude and happiness and who have been trying out some of the techniques on their kids with success. It's all made me optimistic that positive change may be in the air. Parenting trends often move in zigzags. And, we may be ready for a really fresh take on how to make our children more joyful eaters.
So briefly, you've touched on a couple of them throughout, but if there are a couple of tools that a parent could take away from this chat to open their kids' palate up a bit, what do you recommend?
I think, trying to have a child who is a little hungry before a meal, that's not a punishment. That's a source of pleasure. So trying not to have a child snack too much before a meal or not to drink too much milk or juice. And then, kids get so much marketing about junk food. You can be an enthusiastic proponent as a parent of the food that you love to eat. It is perfectly good to talk about, the sensory qualities of foods you find delicious, whether it's spicy food or earthy beans or something that's tangy. Nothing is off limits. There's no evidence that children are naturally scared of green or vegetables. Our species grew up eating all kinds of vegetables and plants. You can describe lovingly the kinds of food that you enjoy. You can offer a food multiple times at the same meal. There is absolutely no ceiling on the number of times you can offer a food, ever. This is, of course, the most difficult thing I say, but to the degree that parents are comfortable with it, not offering alternative foods is probably the most direct way of getting a child to feel that the family meal is the meal and that is what they need to eat. For most of history, this is just how it worked because people didn't have alternative foods. And if parents can have this confidence that children really are capable of learning to like these foods, and confidence is a big part of it, it really changes the perspective on that. And I think that's just incredibly potent in getting kids to like new foods.
Oh, Helen, thank you so much for joining me. Helen Zoe Veit is an Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. She specializes in American food in the 19th and 20th centuries. And her latest book is called Picky: How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. Thank you for your texts as well. Deb says, I'm loving this conversation and it's extremely important. I grew up in the 1960s and we didn't have options. We had to eat what was put in front of us. Maybe that was because of financial reasons. These days, what I've noticed is that people say to kids, what do you want for dinner? I don't agree with this unless it's a special event like a birthday. I didn't raise my kids that way. It's not a restaurant. There's no choice. We sat together, down together, and we all ate the same meal. But Deb does continue. However, I have hit a bit of a hiccup because one of my grandchildren has celiac. So I've had to redefine a lot of our meals.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.